Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. Back in 2002, at the beginning of 2002, the U.S. government began to send individuals it suspected of being involved in terrorism to a prison camp at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The administration argued that these people had a particular, special, unusual status. It ruled that they were enemy combatants. It said that they were not part of a regular army, and so they were not due the kind of protections that are afforded by the Geneva Convention. Of course, they were not U.S. citizens either. And so, as a result, the administration ruled that they were not entitled to representation. They were not entitled to know what the charges were against them. They were held there in secret. Sometimes it was very difficult to find out exactly who the government was holding. And essentially, they were put into a kind of a legal limbo, with the administration reserving the right to hold them without charge, without trial, in effect, forever. A lot of people in this country and elsewhere, civil libertarians, people who were involved in human rights work, said that this was wrong, and that these individuals deserve the same kind of protections, that is, the right to a hearing, to a speedy trial, to legal representation, that any American would. And this morning we'll be talking with one of the many American lawyers who's been involved in Guantanamo litigation. His name is Gary Isaac. He practices law in Chicago. He's a graduate of Yale Law School and since 2003 has been involved in a number of cases involving Guantanamo detainees. He was here in our area just a couple of weeks ago. In fact, he was the speaker at a gathering of the Champaign County chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. This was on Sunday the 22nd, and we're very pleased that he could be talking with us. That is, Gary Isaac could be talking with us, and he's talking with us this morning by phone. So as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. We welcome people in the conversation. We ask only that callers are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along. But of course, anyone's welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if you're listening in Chicago or around Illinois and Indiana, if you're listening over the air or anywhere on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. And that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Isaac, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good, thank you.
Well, thanks for talking with us. Just let me ask you how it is that you became first involved in working, doing some of this work on behalf of the Guantanamo detainees.
Actually, I had been watching developments after 9/11, some of the things that our government had been doing, like setting up Guantanamo as a prison, and I had wanted to become involved just because I thought that the issues were very, very important. And actually, I got a call from a fellow named Doug Castle, who is at the time the director of the Center for International Human Rights, I think it was called, at Northwestern University Law School in Chicago, asking me if I would be willing to write an amicus or friend of the court brief in the Supreme Court on behalf of retired military officers, urging the Supreme Court to take the detainee's case.
Mm-hmm.
And I agreed.
Yeah. And maybe just for people who don't really understand what that means, a friend of the court brief, what exactly does that mean?
Well, at the time that I was asked to become involved, there had been some habeas corpus petitions filed by the detainees. And David, if you'd like, I can step back and explain.
We better. Yes, let's do that.
Habeas corpus is an ancient procedure or right, actually goes back at least to Magna Carta. It is venerated in the law, and it is enshrined in the Constitution. And the basic idea of habeas corpus is that the king, or in this case the president, cannot throw anyone in prison on his own say-so without having an independent court have an opportunity to look at the imprisonment and decide whether there, in fact, is a legal and factual basis for keeping the person in prison. So it's as simple as, you know, if you think of the king throwing someone in the Tower of London, the relatives of someone the king throws in the Tower of London in England could go to court, and lawyers could make the king respond to an independent judge and defend putting the relative in prison. So this was considered so important by the founders that they put it in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 9, in something called the Suspension Clause, which basically says that this right to go to court for habeas corpus may not be suspended except by Congress, and then only in times of rebellion or invasion. And so I think the founders understood that really all of our civil and political rights flow from the idea that the government can't throw us in prison, you know, for what we're doing. And the protection against being thrown in prison arbitrarily is that you have the right to go to court. So that's really what habeas corpus is, and I think that it comes from the Latin phrase, which it used to, you know, literally require the jailer to bring the body, the corpus, to court, to the judge, so that the judge could decide whether there was a basis for the imprisonment or not. So that's kind of a short primer on habeas corpus, and, you know, it is still an accepted practice and again, an important practice in part of our law. And at the time that I became involved in the late summer, I guess, of 2003, the lower court, there had been habeas corpus petitions that had been filed in the district court in Washington, D.C. on behalf of some of the detainees at Guantanamo. And those petitions had actually been dismissed by the district court, and then the Court of Appeals in Washington had affirmed the dismissal. And the basic rationale for the dismissal was that the detainees were not U.S. citizens and that they were being held outside U.S. territory, and therefore they essentially had no rights. And that was the position that the government was taking. And so I was asked to write what's called a friend of the court or amicus brief. And an amicus brief is when someone who's not a party is asked to write a brief on behalf of someone who is deemed to have a perspective, you know, that they want to bring to the attention of the court. And so in this instance, there was a strategy to try to have different groups, you know, not usual suspects, so to speak, submit briefs to the court to explain how the government's Guantanamo policy and the idea of having a prison beyond the law was a very negative thing, and was really, really undercutting American policy and a bad thing for various reasons. And so, for example, the brief that we wrote was on behalf of two retired admirals and a retired general. The two admirals had been actually the former judge advocate generals or top lawyer for the Navy, and one of them was actually in the Pentagon on 9/11 and had friends killed, and the third was a former top lawyer for the Marines. And one of the arguments that they made in their brief was that the government's policy of putting the detainees at Guantanamo and giving them no rights and no hearings of any kind, no due process at all, was really very dangerous for American servicemen and women, because it was making it, you know, kind of what goes around comes around. And if we take prisoners and give them no rights and just kind of try to put them in a prison beyond the law, accountable to no one, then it makes it easier for other countries to do the same thing, to take into custody American servicemen and women and hold them and without explanation, without offering any kind of process. And so that was, you know, one of the arguments that we made in our amicus brief. And there were other amicus briefs which were very compelling as well. There was an amicus brief by former U.S. diplomats that talked about the negative effect that Guantanamo was having on U.S. standing around the world. There was an amicus brief that was filed by former federal judges who argued that the government's policy was really counter to American standards about the rule of law. And, you know, there was actually a very compelling brief that was submitted on behalf of Fred Korematsu, who's was a Japanese-American who was interned during World War II and who challenged that, and whose name is on a very famous Supreme Court decision from the era that kind of upheld the internment of Japanese-Americans. Of course, that's subsequently been repudiated, and everyone recognizes that was a bad thing. And so he brought a great deal of moral force to this issue. So we were one of several amicus – ours was one of several amicus briefs. Our brief and Mr. Korematsu's got a lot of attention at the time, because of the particular people we were writing on behalf of, and it was, I think, considered particularly compelling to people that former military lawyers and officers were saying that the detainees should be permitted to challenge their detention in court.
Mm-hmm. As you say, there is this very basic principle that's in the Constitution of the United States that goes back in the law on which it is based that is afforded, this kind of protections are afforded all U.S. citizens. That is the idea that if you're arrested, you're entitled to know what you're charged with. You're entitled to a speedy hearing of some sort. Within a reasonable amount of time, you're entitled to legal representation. And that it seems that in when it comes to the Guantanamo detainees, there was, at least initially, maybe still, a lot of argument about just what their status is, that what, if any, kinds of law are they covered by. There, some people would say, well, they're not U.S. citizens, so they're not covered by U.S. law and shouldn't have the protection of the Constitution. The Bush administration, as I said, argued, well, they're not regular army, so they're not covered by the Geneva Convention. How does one make the argument that, or would you make the argument that even though they're not U.S. citizens, and perhaps even though they're not being held in the United on U.S. soil, that was another one of the arguments, that they still should be due the same sorts of legal protections that a U.S. citizen would be due if that person had been arrested and for some crime within the boundaries of the United States?
Well, I mean, that the without kind of digressing or making this more complicated, we can come back to it if you like, because Congress last year passed a law called the Military Commission Act, which attempted to take away the right of habeas corpus from any non-citizen, even within the United States, who is been accused of being an enemy combatant or even is awaiting a determination of whether they're an enemy combatant. But putting that law aside and the constitutionality of that law is being challenged, before that law was passed, certainly any non-U.S. citizen who was within the United States would, you know, have these continental rights and would certainly have the right to habeas corpus if they were put in prison. The government argued that Guantanamo is a different place and that it's not part of the United States because we are at the naval base at Guantanamo as part of a lease that was entered into in 1903 with the government of Cuba that gives the U.S. exclusive jurisdiction and control. Those are the words of the lease, but says that ultimate sovereignty it resides in Cuba. Now, what we think that means really is that at such time as we leave, sovereignty would revert to Cuba. And again, for all intents and purposes, this is U.S. territory. We have total control for as long as we like. That's what the lease says. So this is really, Guantanamo is unique because we can stay there for literally as long as we like. And the lease says that we have total control. So in every other respect, U.S. law applies at Guantanamo. In fact, it was, I think, one of the Justice Souter at the oral argument in the case that we submitted the brief on in 2004, said to the government's lawyer, but basically, for example, U.S. environmental law applies at Guantanamo. So the Cuban iguana has greater rights under U.S. law, you're saying, than these human beings. And that is the government's position. But it's ridiculous, frankly, to be saying that people in U.S. custody at Guantanamo somehow are entitled to fewer rights. So that is why we are saying that they should be permitted, just as citizens, or before this Military Commissions Act was passed, non-citizens in the U.S. should be permitted to challenge their detention. Basically, you know, they're in the U.S. custody in a place where the U.S. has total dominion.
Just, I have a couple of callers. We'll get to them, but I want to come back and pick up this point about the Military Commissions Act. Now,
yes.
when Guantanamo was first set up, I think even before that, I think that the president said that it was his intention, if we picked up suspected terrorists, that they would be subject to military trials and that would not have the same kind of provisions that are there for other kinds of trials, civil or criminal, that go on in the United States. A lot of people objected to that all the way along. Finally, about a year ago, it was last June, the Supreme Court ruled that the Bush administration had gone too far in ordering military commission trials. And they said that, in fact, yes, the Geneva Conventions do apply to these people. And this was all based on the Hamdan case.
Right, right.
And that then in response, though, then last fall, the Congress passed this Military Commissions Act allowing the administration to try foreign nationals held in Guantanamo. So I guess I'm sort of confused about now where we are, because it sounded like the Supreme Court said to the administration, no, you can't do what you wanted to do. And it looked like there was that then what they would have to do would be to if they were going to try these people, to try them in an American criminal court. Now, does this knock us back then to where we were before?
Well, they're kind of, there are a few questions there. Let me try to.
I know that.
No, that's okay.
A lot.
I'll try to answer them kind of. And if you think I miss one, let me know. But basically, the military commissions do not apply to most of the detainees at Guantanamo. They only apply to a very small number. Those detainees are actually being charged with violating the laws of war, in other words, with war crimes. And that, you know, that's only about 5 or 10 people have been charged so far with war crimes. David Hicks was one of them. Mr. Hamdan, who is alleged to have been Osama bin Laden's driver, is another one. I think, you know, they recently brought several a number of so-called high-value prisoners like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to Guantanamo. But the military commissions only apply to a very, very small fraction of the population at Guantanamo. And so it's only for those who are actually charged with war crimes who would get trials before some kind of like a court-martial or military trial. The rest of the detainees, 350 or so, or 360 of the 385 or so who are remaining, will never probably be charged with any war crimes, will never get any military commissions, and so that whole proceeding is irrelevant to them. They are being held not because they are alleged war criminals, but solely as alleged enemy combatants. And so that's kind of an important distinction. Now, what happened in Hamdan is that the administration has set up these military trials to try the handful that were charged with war crimes, and those proceedings were challenged as unconstitutional by the lawyers representing those detainees. And the Supreme Court in Hamdan said that the proceedings that had been set up were not constitutional. But they indicated that it is possible that Congress could, if Congress spoke, Congress could create military commissions that would be constitutional. Congress then responded to the Supreme Court's decision by passing the Military Commissions Act, which, by the way, was something like, it was a 91-page bill. The first 89 pages of it dealt with the military commissions, and the last 2 pages stuck on at the back was this provision that tried to take away the jurisdiction of the courts to hear the habeas corpus cases for all the detainees. So so that's kind of where we are now. And the lawyers for the detainees who were subject to military commissions are still saying that the military commissions that were created by the Military Commissions Act are still not sufficient and do not satisfy the constitutional requirements. But, again, that issue about the adequacy of the military commissions really doesn't apply to, you know, most of the detainees at Guantanamo.
And over time now, a number of the detainees have been released.
Right.
So one wonders these more than 300 people there that are left, what's going to happen to them?
Well, it's kind of an irony, actually, that the people who are said to be the worst of the worst get more procedure and more due process than the rest. And so even someone like David Hicks, who, you know, was denounced as being a dangerous guy, and that's why he was charged with war crimes, he was going to be tried before a military commission. And in the course of that, the government plea bargained with his lawyers, and the agreement was that he would only have to serve 9 more months in prison, and he would be returned to Australia, and then he could be freed. And the only other condition, was that he agreed, I think, for 2 years not to talk about how he had been treated by the government. So it looks like a gag rule was put in by the government just because they did not want Mr. Hicks talking about conditions at Guantanamo, and he had alleged that he had been abused and tortured. And so to have him not talk about the way he'd been treated, they agreed, and to not have a trial that would be public in which he'd have a chance to talk about what he alleged was his mistreatment. They agreed to let him go home, and he's going to be a free man in 9 months. So a guy who's charged with war crimes, said to be a really bad guy, maybe not true, but those are the allegations against him. He's going to be free in 9 months, and most of the other guys who are not charged with any war crimes, again, you know, they're just, at worst, most of them are just alleged to have been Taliban foot soldiers, although many of the detainees were not even picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan. They were picked up in Pakistan and were sold for bounties by the Northern Alliance or warlords to the U.S. Those guys, you know, may just be there for a long time unless the courts step in and say they're entitled to have fair hearings and then actually conduct hearings to determine whether there's a basis for holding them or not. Because a lot of them, you know, they say they're just, you know, there's really not a factual basis for holding them, even if the government has the legal authority to hold someone who was, you know, caught on the battlefield. They're saying that, you know, they're the wrong guys. They were sold for bounties. Imagine, you know, the government was offering bounties of $25,000 or $50,000, and if you look at they dropped flyers, you know, and they were distributing flyers in Afghanistan that and Pakistan that said, you know, you can earn enough money to pay for your village for the whole, you know, the rest of their lives. That's an enormous sum of money. You know, as if someone in the U.S. said, you know, we'll give you $5 million or $10 million if you turn someone in. You know, can we all say that there's no one who would turn us in if they were offered a huge sum of money to take care of their family for the rest of their lives? And so, you know, other people were taken into custody, you know, in other countries. They're not even alleged to have been anywhere near a battlefield.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Gary Isaac. He's an attorney. He practices law in Chicago and since the fall of 2003 has been involved in a number of litigations involving the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a number of callers here. We'll start in with line number one, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, a few weeks ago, David had a lieutenant commander from the Navy along with a law professor on, and I raised this question to him, and this was in the aftermath of the Hamdan decision and the Military Commissions Act, especially that part which seems to preclude habeas proceedings for the detainees, whether he won the battle at Hamdan and lost the war in light of the Military Commissions Act. I'm buttressing that question now in the light of the fact that federal courts, and I believe the D.C. Circuit, have denied petitions from the detainees because of a lack of military federal jurisdiction under the Military Commissions Act, and I believe the Supreme Court of the United States, especially with Justices Stevens and Kennedy, have concurred in a denial of cert. Kennedy and Stevens seemingly saying, let things work out through the Military Commissions Act, military commissions, and then we'll look at this again, perhaps. If that's the case, can't these 300 or so people just languish indefinitely as this war on terror continues? And really, haven't we done a great disservice to the great writ, the writ of habeas?
Yes. In a word, yes. I think that, just kind of a history lesson or a history digression. The first, after the Supreme Court held in 2004 that the courts did have jurisdiction and the detainees could challenge their detentions by bringing habeas corpus petitions in the courts, Congress or the Republicans in Congress, largely led by Senator Graham of South Carolina, passed something called the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005, which attempted to take away the jurisdiction of the courts. And the Supreme Court in the Hamdan case said that it interpreted that statute as applying only in the future and not applying to any of the hundreds of habeas corpus petitions that had been filed already and were pending. After the Supreme Court did that, in the Military Commissions Act, Congress then put another provision in that that attempted to take away the jurisdiction of the courts, and it's that provision that the D.C. Circuit, the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., held do apply and took away the jurisdiction of the courts to hear the cases. The Supreme Court, we asked the Supreme Court to review that, and the caller is correct that three justices thought the Supreme Court should hear the case now. Justices Kennedy and Stevens explained that they were not voting to hear the case now because there actually is an alternative procedure under the Detainee Treatment Act, if I may, David, take one more minute
sure,
to explain.
Yeah.
right after the Supreme Court decided the case in 2004, and there had been no process at all, 9 days later, Paul Wolfowitz, who had been in the news lately for other reasons, he was the Deputy Secretary of Defense. He issued an order that created something called Combatant Status Review Tribunals, or CSRTs as they are called. And these were tribunals that were set up supposedly to decide whether individuals were enemy combatants or not. Or actually, they were set up expressly to confirm the decisions already made that the individuals were enemy combatants. And these were the detainees did not have lawyers, even though many of the detainees already were represented by lawyers. The Defense Department did not allow lawyers to participate. The rules of these proceedings allowed for evidence obtained by torture to be relied on. It allowed for secret evidence, hearsay evidence. It was basically after the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and the deputy secretary of defense had already pronounced these individuals to be enemy combatants and the worst of the worst, it then fell upon three officers to confirm that determination in these CSRTs. Predictably, most of the CSRTs found that the individuals, you know, were enemy combatants. Those have been challenged in courts. And under the Detainee Treatment Act, the only process that is supposed to be left for the detainees with, if there is no habeas corpus, is a very limited proceeding to go to the back to the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and challenge the results of these combatant status review tribunals. But the only thing that the scope of review, as we say as lawyers, basically the only thing that Court of Appeals can look at is whether or not the CSRTs followed their own procedures. And since the procedures allowed for torture evidence and hearsay and secret evidence and no lawyers, we say that on their face they were inadequate and they're a sham. And, you know, there have been studies done, and I think they were a sham. And there were instances where people were found not to be enemy combatants and they were told to do it again, and they did it again two or three times until they got the result that people were enemy combatants. And so what Justice Kennedy and Stevens are saying, though, is they're saying we want to give the Court of Appeals in Washington a chance to look at some of these CSRTs and interpret the law and decide whether these CSRTs were an adequate substitute for habeas corpus, because under the Constitution, Congress may not suspend the writ of habeas corpus, but if there is an alternative, what's called an adequate and effective substitute provided, then that's okay. It doesn't run afoul of the Constitution. So what the Justices Kennedy and Stevens are basically saying is they want to see whether these CSRT procedures reviewed by the Court of Appeals under this very limited review for whether the CSRTs follow their own procedures could be an adequate and effective substitute for habeas corpus. And so they're going to let that run its course for a little bit. And that is why I think they did not grant review, you know, a couple of months ago when we asked for it. I think ultimately we're going to get to the Supreme Court, but they don't want to jump the gun. At least Kennedy and Stevens, they thought it would be jumping the gun to do it now without giving the Court of Appeals itself a chance to analyze and apply the Detainee Treatment Act.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Thanks for the call. Let's go to next caller, Belgium, the community, not too far away from here. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I've listened to you folks talk about this, and it seems fairly complicated topic and concept in many ways. And the question I have about the situation is, I'm sure the gentleman who's now residing in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue doesn't have the brains to come up with all this. Who was a person that started this, came up with the idea to say, this is such a subtle difference that we can make a rule to make it go that way?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, who actually is considered the architect of this policy. But clearly the intent was, in the wake of 9/11, to take people and I think to round up as many people as they could for interrogation and put them somewhere where they could be held and maybe subjected to extreme interrogation techniques where they could be held for as long as the government wanted to without being answerable to anybody.
I think we ought to find that person. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana next, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Seems to me when we are at war and we capture an enemy soldier in an enemy uniform, this enemy soldier is made a prisoner of war. He has no due process rights. He is held until the end of the war, and habeas corpus does not apply to him. Correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the Guantanamo detainees were enemy soldiers at war with our country, but without an enemy uniform, without an enemy homeland. These soldiers were literally members of a private organization. They were Al-Qaeda fighters, and they were making war on the United States, not wearing a uniform. Now, I'm not talking about people who were turned over to us for a bounty. Now, I'm talking about active belligerents. And I think traditionally, active belligerents making war against us out of uniform would be viewed as spies and would have fewer rights than a uniformed enemy soldier.
Actually, under the that's a good question. Under the Geneva Conventions and under Army military regulations, if you pick up somebody and there's question about what their status is, you're supposed to have a hearing in the field. It's called a 190-8 hearing to determine whether they are, in fact, an enemy soldier or an innocent civilian or, in fact, someone who has violated the law, like by fighting outside of uniform or something like that. And those kinds of hearings were held in the field. For example, in the first Gulf War, they had 1,200 hearings, and I think 800 of the people who had been picked up were determined to be innocent civilians and were freed. And so there is supposed to be a procedure in the field for, you know, separating people who actually are taking up arms against us from those who might have been, you know, caught up in the fog of war or picked up for other reasons. And so those hearings, though, the Defense Department wanted to have those hearings in the field, and the White House put the kibosh on it, and they were never held.
Oh.
But the other problem is that, and one of the reasons, you know, we think it's really important to have habeas corpus in this case, if those hearings had been held in the field and you were just holding people as, because they were, you know, in the traditional way, because they were fighting against you on the battlefield, you know, all of this debate about the courts, you know, might not be necessary. But part of the problem is they're also, you know, only 8%, I think, of the people at Guantanamo are even accused of being Al-Qaeda fighters. And, you know, it's how to determine who are the guys you really want to hold, who have you have a basis for hold, you know, versus the people who were sold for bounties, you know, who were picked up in the fog of war. You know, that's why you need habeas corpus now, because we didn't make any determinations at, you know, at or near the time or place of capture, even though the military regulations call for that. And so, you know, there are a lot of people there. I think everyone acknowledges, in fact, you know, the deputy commander of Guantanamo said that a lot of the people there were running, they were not fighting. They were just kind of picked up for the wrong reasons. But, you know, that's why you need a procedure now to figure out really who the right guys are and who are not the right guys.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Well, what about the question that the caller raised about if these people were, if they were considered to be a regular army, they were wearing a uniform, that we wouldn't be talking about whether habeas applied to them or not. And in fact, the precedent is that you can hold them, essentially until the war is over, you can hold them.
But the precedent is also that you have a procedure in the field to make that determination, and there was no such procedure held here and done here as the military regulations require. They ignored the military regulations. The other problem is that many of the people here were not picked up anywhere near a battlefield, and the government has used such an expansive definition of enemy combatant that it applies to people far from a battlefield. If, in fact, the government is now holding as an enemy combatant someone who was arrested at his home in Peoria, Illinois, a legal, a non-citizen, but a legal alien. He was here legally studying at Bradley University, who was arrested right after 9/11 and is now being held as an enemy combatant.
Let's talk again with another caller. This is, next person is in Champaign, and it's line 3. Hello.
Yes. I think you spoke briefly to the issue of Hicks, but I was wondering what happened exactly on this first day of his trial, and I apologize if I missed out on that explanation, but it seemed to me that suddenly his two of his three lawyers were ordered off the case at the last minute, and that seems to have been the point at which he decided to give up. And it was very rarely reported on in the media, the fact that it certainly to any great degree that his two of his three lawyers had been ordered off the case. I was wondering why? What was the reason why these lawyers were kept off the case? And my impression was all the more that it was a kind of kangaroo court, the way that this was set up.
Well, I think the way it played out, that's how it certainly seemed. Two of his lawyers were civilian defense counsel who were permitted under the rules. He was permitted to have civilian defense counsel. They had agreed, as a condition of participating in the case, to abide by the military's rules. They didn't waive the right to challenge the rules in court later, but they agreed to abide by them so long as they were the rules. And what happened was, apparently at the first day of trial, that one of the military judges, the presiding judge, told the defense counsel, the civilian defense counsel, he asked them to agree that they would abide by any rules that would be subsequently issued relating to the proceedings. And they basically said, look, we've agreed to abide by the rules that we see. We can't tell you that we agreed to abide by the rules that you're going to issue later without knowing what they are. And he said, well, unless you're willing to say flat out now, unequivocally, that you'll abide by any rules we issue in the future, you can't participate. So he kicked them off the case, basically, the first day. And I think it did look, ridiculous, frankly, to expect people to sign on to procedures that they haven't been issued yet. The interesting thing was, and again, this is why this interplay and how it's ironic, in a sense, that Hicks will be free soon, because under the military commission's proceedings, if someone is acquitted by a military commission, in other words, if you're one of this small percentage, the small fraction who actually is accused of a war crime and you get this military trial, if you are acquitted, that does not mean you get to be free, because the government still reserves the right to hold you as an enemy combatant, like the other 365 or so detainees that they're holding just as enemy combatants. So Hicks, if he had actually gone ahead with his trial and been acquitted, the government still could have held him as an enemy combatant. And so, but by virtue of his plea bargain, he got them to agree to only sentence him to 9 months, and it was agreed that he would then be free. So he came out way ahead of anybody else there.
Something I find just interesting in all of this is just the sense, given all that you're saying, that the executive has just willy-nilly gone after as much executive power as it could vis-a-vis these so-called combatants. And I'm just wondering, there was a lawyer who was on campus here recently who was on the show, actually, and I forget his name, but he was saying that, this is a new post 9/11 situation and so forth, and that it takes, that these military commissions are legitimate. Although he had some concerns about habeas corpus, if I recall. But what I want to know is, what really, in your opinion, is really new here? We've always had, issues of terrorism and guerrilla warfare and so on. What in your mind is the linchpin that allows them to get away with this? Is it simply the public mood and the concern over quote-unquote terrorism and the quote-unquote war on terrorism?
I think that's part of it. I don't think we, obviously we do have a new threat, but we've, faced other threats before. As I was in a discussion last week, and someone pointed out, we faced a serious threat in World War II. We were fighting an enemy that wanted to destroy us and was evil. We don't need to throw over our laws, and we should not throw out our laws and all of our protections. I think the founders understood. The courts have understood over our history, that it is in time of stress when it is all the more important that we recognize the importance of checks and balances and the separation of powers. That's part of our constitutional system, and part of the greatness of our constitutional system is that it recognizes that, power should not be concentrated in any one branch of government. And I think this president has attempted to, concentrate power and authority in the presidency in a way that it's scary. And, to me, when the president can arrest or have someone taken into custody in their home in Peoria and claims the right to hold that person as an enemy combatant indefinitely without letting them see a lawyer, without having them without charging them with a crime, without giving them a trial, that's very troubling.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Gary Isaac. He's an attorney. He practices law in Chicago and has been involved in Guantanamo litigation since the fall of 2003 when he authored two Friend of the Court briefs in the Rossell case. This was on behalf of some retired military officers who were urging the Supreme Court to hear the detainee's case and also urging the court to hold that courts, U.S. courts, have jurisdiction to entertain detainees' petitions for habeas corpus. Since the court's decision in June in 2004 in that case, Mr. Isaac has also been involved with a number of attorneys in bringing habeas actions on behalf of those being held at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll talk next with someone here in Champaign County where we are, line number one. Hello.
As far as the culpability, it seems to me, of course, it goes to the top, but the name of Bybee and you stick in one mind because they're the people that were on board. Bybee has been put on the ninth court in the West Coast area, but Gonzalez himself, when they were talking about habeas corpus, there's a vignette, I think it's up on Crooks and Liars, you can watch it, where he says, just because the Constitution says that the habeas corpus can't be taken away doesn't mean that everybody has it.
Right.
It's absolutely surreal moment with Spector, and it was just absolutely astonishing. It was another Alice in through the Looking Glass kind of thing, where just like the court where you have to agree in advance to all of the rules that haven't been written yet. But I wanted to mention that there's an Interfaith Alliance group that's did a screening of the film Road to Guantanamo, a British film that is just absolutely overwhelming because it illustrates the Tipton Five story and about how they got swept up into it and how three of them ended up in Guantanamo, I think it was three. Just really illustrates it. The most shocking thing about it was in the discussion that this Chaplain Yee, the Muslim chaplain who was accused of all sorts of malfeasance and then left off the let go, says that actually the illustrations of degradation and torture were actually not sufficiently drastic to represent what was really going on in Guantanamo. So I just wanted to commend and also mention that this Interfaith Alliance has a campaign to restore habeas corpus and illegal detention, et cetera.
Thank you very much. Actually, that's wonderful, and I should just say for the audience that actually we are in the middle right now of a very intense push in Congress to ask Congress to restore the jurisdiction of the courts to hear these habeas corpus cases. So I would ask anyone who's listening who agrees with us to get on the phone and call your senators and call your congressmen and women and urge them to support, write to them and urge them to support legislation to restore the right of habeas corpus.
I appreciate your work, and I'm happy to hear that this is a campaign. It is absolutely scandalous. And on the specifics of the jurisdiction, I don't know. It just seems to be another Alice in Wonderland thing, where because that land is Cuban. I actually think you need to look at the actual lease, though, because I believe the lease was supposed to be renewed and never was renewed. So it's actually probably an illegal occupation.
Well, the lease was actually it was originally entered into in 1903, and then there was a treaty entered into in 1934, which basically said that the U.S. may remain there for as long as it wishes, and uses the base as a naval station.
Well, again, we have about 5 minutes left. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess I'm afraid that we're kind of coming back to the same point, but I think that we're still left with this question about for those, it may be, as you say, that there would be a handful of people that are considered to be extremely important, people high up in Al-Qaeda, so forth, where there may indeed be military tribunals held. But we have this now 360 people who are there who haven't been charged with war crimes, maybe never will go before one of these military tribunals, are considered to be enemy combatants. They've been there now for years. And again, I guess we come back to this basic question of what happens to these people? And now, interestingly enough, just recently there was an article, this was last week in the New York Times, talking about the fact that some of these people have been there so long, they're so justifiably angry with the fact that they've been held. They're now to the point where they're not even talking with their lawyers anymore, perhaps in part because they don't trust them or that they don't think that it's going to do them any good to talk to their lawyers.
I think a lot of the people there have been there for over 5 years, and I think there is a lot of despair there, and it's traceable to the fact that it's been such a slow process, agonizingly slow, and now you have efforts with Congress, the Republicans in Congress, you know, ramming through legislation to take away the jurisdiction of the courts, and then the Court of Appeals upholding that. For now, I think it has given rise to great desperation on the part of many of the detainees. I'm not a death penalty lawyer, but my understanding from colleagues who actually do criminal defense work is that, you know, there's such failings of despair and kind of are not uncommon for long-term prisoners, and that, you know, often in death penalty cases too, prisoners start to not want to see their lawyers because it's something they can try to control.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that for anything to change, that now, of course, the court makeup of the court is not going to change, but that would it make a difference if there was a change of administration?
Well, I think first of all, it would make a big difference if the law were changed again. To go back to what the Supreme Court said the law was 3 years ago, then we wouldn't have to fight about this issue of whether the courts even can consider these cases. But I think if the cases can get back in court, eventually there will be some kind of fair judicial process and hearings, and we'll, you know, hopefully separate the people who there's a basis for detaining from the people who there's no basis for detaining. If there's a change in administration, then presumably, you know, it would be easier to pass legislation as well to restore habeas corpus. I do think if we get back to the Supreme Court, we will win this issue.
Mm-hmm. Has there not, though, been all along an effort to try to sort through these people, to try to find out who perhaps should be there and who not? After all, people have been released.
Well, ostensibly, these CSRTs, or Combatant Status Review Tribunals, were doing that, but from all of the data that we have and all the review of those proceedings, they clearly did not, and they were, sham proceedings. And I'll give you an example. There was one guy who was accused of being of associating with a suicide bomber, and he was held there as an enemy combatant because of this. And, you know, putting aside whether or not you should be held for the rest of your life for associating with somebody else, his lawyers found out, it turned out, that the suicide bomber is still alive and well and is in Germany and is not even suspected of any wrongdoing. And so, you know, that kind of exculpatory evidence could not be presented. The detainee had no lawyer at the CSRT and had no ability to bring that, to even know that fact. The two federal judges who've looked at the CSRTs have found that they were totally inadequate, did not measure up to due process. There's another case where the CSRT told the man that he was accused of associating with a known al-Qaeda operative, and he said, "Who is it? I don't know who it's possible, that someone I work with or a neighbor or someone, who is it? If you tell me, I can answer the charges." Excuse me, and they said, "We can't tell you that." And the federal judge, used that as an example of a kind of, it's an Orwellian example. Just imagine you're being charged with knowing somebody, and they won't even tell you who it is, so that you can rebut the charges.
We're coming down to the point here. We have maybe a minute or so left, and I guess again, I feel like coming back almost to the point where we started. Some people, I think, might find this complicated, and it is complicated following the path that this has taken and the various courts that have ruled and have some sort of jurisdiction. But I suppose that the important point that you started with, and maybe the thing that we could end with, is why it should matter. For U.S. citizens, why should it matter that somebody else who is not a citizen and maybe was involved in acting against the United States, why should it matter that these persons don't get these kind of legal protections that we take for granted?
I think it matters because this could be a first step. These are non-citizens held outside U.S. territory, even though in a place that the U.S. totally controls. But this administration has attempted to expand that to apply to U.S. citizens taken outside, arrested elsewhere, and even to a U.S. citizen, Mr. Padilla, and a non-U.S. citizen arrested in Peoria. And so it's really critically important. Habeas corpus has been the bedrock of our constitutional system since the beginning. It's an ancient right that goes back to Magna Carta. The founders recognize how important it is. All of our liberties flow from the notion that the president can't throw us in prison without having an independent court look at it and decide whether there's a basis for it. If the president has the right to do that, then really all of our other civil liberties will disappear.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Isaac, for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest, Gary Isaac, he's an attorney. He practices in Chicago. He is in the firm of Meyer, Brown, and Platt, it's now Meyer, Brown, Rowe, and Moa in Chicago. He's been there since 1986, and since the fall of 2003, he's been involved in Guantanamo litigation, one of the many attorneys across the country that have been involved in filing briefs on behalf of the individuals arguing that they were indeed entitled to the same rights that U.S. citizens are entitled to under the Constitution of the United States.